Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the last weekend of June 2025. We are just a little over a week past the summer solstice, so still squarely in the very long days time of year, but the days are now slowly starting to get shorter. If you had a chance to get out over the last couple of weeks, we did have a little bit of sun here in Sitka, but of course, we don't always let the rain stop us from getting out either. I had a chance to get out and see some birds, trip to Sea Lion Cove here north of Sitka. My son and I spotted a snowy plover, which was only the second documented snowy plover in Alaska ever. So that was kind of a fun one for us. You never know what might be around this time of year. Sometimes birds, they call it overshoot. They overshoot where their normal range is and start wandering around in other locations. If you're getting out and seeing a bird that seems unusual to you, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. It's also a time that the young are out of the nests. We had flickers nesting in our yard as well as chickadees. Both of those have fledged over the last two or three weeks. So it's a time when there's a lot of bird activity around. They'll start gathering up and heading south here before too long. But in the meantime, it's a great time to be out and observing. The conversation I have for this week's show is one that I recorded this past week with Ron Heintz. Ron has been at the Sitka Sound Science Center for the past several years after retiring from a 35-year career as a fisheries biologist with NOAA. Over the years, he worked on herring in Prince William Sound and a little bit in southeast Alaska, but also on salmonids, salmon, and other related fish in southeast Alaska. As well, in recent years, he's been part of various projects through the Science Center looking at landslide risk. We'll go ahead and join the conversation with him talking a little bit about the work he's done on herring.
I did some herring work in southeast Alaska, but I did a lot of herring work in Prince William Sound.
Oh, okay. Like post-Exxon Valdez?
Yeah. I was pretty involved with the Exxon Valdez oil spill, doing a lot of the research that was involved in the damage assessment and then also in a lot of the restoration work.
Okay, wow. So, I mean, is that still ongoing, it seems like?
Yeah, they're still, actually still I'm doing herring stuff in Prince William Sound.
Wow.
I haven't been doing much lately, but I'm engaged in a project up there where we're looking at pink salmon and herring interactions, because one of the hypotheses for why the herring in Prince William Sound have not really recovered is because of the increasing numbers of pink salmon due to the hatchery production in Sound. That was a hypothesis put forward by Exxon years after the spill to try to take the heat off of them for their oil spill.
Yeah, I see. So in their hypothesis would essentially be that, okay, yeah, the oil spill, but it would have recovered now except for now the pink salmon are coming in.
Well, the deal there was is there was a crash in the herring population, and it was due to the onset of this disease, viral hemorrhagic septicemia. But that crash occurred 4 years after the spill. So that was 93. So a connection to the spill was harder to establish. So if the crash had occurred, say, the year before, herring liked to enter into the fishery, recruit into the fishery at age 3. So then you might have thought that the oil spill had something to do with it. But in fact, it was 4 years after the spill, and it seemed to affect the whole population. So it was kind of hard to establish a connection between the oil spill, although it sure looks really suspicious.
Yeah, especially if it hasn't happened anywhere else.
Right. Well, I mean, herring populations crash a lot.
Yeah.
There's actually some of the work that was done in Prince William Sound looked at herring populations all over the world, and they frequently crash. They're kind of a type of fish that kind of they have highly variable population abundance.
Well, that's something I've wondered about over the years, because it's just like, what is the kind of baseline behavior of a population of fish? And obviously, they're targeted in fisheries and have been worldwide for long periods of time. And people, my impression is people don't have the best track record, let's just say, of herring stocks remaining abundant. But if part of that's because there's this natural boom and bust that's happening,
right,
but you keep fishing at boom levels for a little too long, you could suddenly have problems. But I don't know.
Well, you're asking a really good question, and it's one that's really bothered me. Is it's like, well, we say that there's a lot of booms and busts with herring.
Yeah.
But that's fisheries biologists saying that.
Right.
So we've been exploiting herring populations for a really long time. And it's hard to know. Like, it's hard to know what herring populations in Southeast were like sort of pre-contact. So when you talk to a lot of indigenous elders and people in Southeast Alaska, you get the sense that there were herring all over the place in Southeast Alaska, and now you don't see herring that much. And there's this thing called portfolio effects, and that's, you know, fancy term meaning that you have maybe herring in one place will spawn at a certain time, and then herring in another part of Southeast will spawn at another time. And if you look at herring throughout the entire region, that means there's a lot of variability in the spawn timing, or other, or maybe their water temperature tolerances or something. And that kind of ensures that there's always herring around. So this year, maybe the fish over here on the left, I'm pointing to the left in the studio here, where they're not as abundant as normal, but the ones over here on the right are doing really good this year. And so overall, there's always herring around.
Yeah.
And so I think that's probably more likely how things used to work. But now, well, we got the herring in Sitka. There's no herring in Lynn Canal anymore. There's very few herring in Prince William Sound. There's some herring around Craig, which is great. They've come back. And now this year, it looks like Cake got some herring. But it's not like even back in the 80s, I mean, I used to see these giant shoals of herring on Lower Chatham. I used to work down there on the other side of Baranoff at Little Port Walter, and you would see huge shoals of, you know, probably age 3 and 4 herring out in Chatham Strait. And I don't think you see that anymore.
So. Yeah, I remember talking to Marge Ward, who moved here in like 1949, mm-hmm. and she was friends with Carl Kerr, who is a fisherman in this area for a long time.
Right.
Yeah, and he would talk about just traveling for miles over herring through Chatham in the summertime and all that.
Yeah.
But then those reduction plants came in.
Right. You look at Lower Chatham, right? Yeah. And there's a reduction plant in every fjord, right? So there must have been a lot of herring around.
Yeah.
And we don't see it like that anymore. And, you know, so why haven't they come back? That's a big question. That's a really big question.
Yeah. So. And I suppose there's the ocean's a complicated place. The whales mm-hmm. were, you know, suppressed by human harvest and now have come back, and humpback whales are pretty abundant.
Right.
They like to eat herring, but there's also a lot more fish from hatcheries mm-hmm. as you were speaking to, and they like to eat herring. And so it seems like a complicated question to try and tease out even some of the biology, like you're saying, this distributed timing and location kind of stuff that gives a resilience that if that's not there anymore, then what's going on, and how could you support that coming back even?
I think so. One harebrained idea I've had, and this came to me pretty late in my career, is something I would have liked to investigate more, but was thinking about this idea of maybe abundance begets more abundance.
Mm.
So that when you really have large population sizes, you know, outside of being exploited, you know, that they tend to be self-sustaining. And you get a lot more recycling of nutrients in the ocean and that sort of stuff. I guess I got this idea out of listening to some of these lectures about whatever they call it, blue carbon, where there's a lot of carbon recycling up in the photic zone when you have a lot of whales and things like that.
Yeah.
And you have this pump, they call it the whale pump, where the whales go down really deep to forage, and then they come back up in the photic zone, and then they poop out whatever it was they were eating at depth, and then those nutrients become available. And so it's one thought I've had is maybe if you have a large production of herring, and they're all kind of, you know, pooping out in the water, that keeps a lot of those nutrients up high in the water column and keeps it from settling down to the bottom. And so productivity begets more productivity.
Mm.
But, you know, like I said, that's a harebrained idea that I came up with. And, you know, who knows? That's, you know, it's kind of out there. But I've always wondered if we had all those herring, I mean, the sunlight hasn't changed hitting the planet.
No.
So,
yeah.
So we're, you know, presumably primary production could still be the same levels it was, say, in the 40s or the 20s and 30s in Southeast Alaska. Then where did all that where's all that productivity now? We don't see it so much. You know, salmon populations are kind of not what they used to be. Herring aren't what they used to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, my background is math and statistics stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, like, with the math, there, when you have these dynamic systems, you know, you can have stable sort of attractors, essentially.
Right,
like,
exactly.
But yeah, there can be more than one,
right,
you know, at different places. So
yeah,
you find this stable equilibrium, essentially, at this lower population,
yeah,
or this upper one. But it's hard to get between them without,
right,
a big,
exactly,
something.
Yeah, you know? There's a couple really great papers on the history of fisheries. And like, you'll have a stable state, and then you'll execute a fishery, and maybe that'll influence this forage fish stock or something, and then it'll just shift the whole productivity system into another basin.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider the implications of that, you know,
right,
because it's hard to know in advance, right? It's complicated enough, you can't really model everything.
Right.
So
yeah.
So then it's kind of like after the fact, you can say, well, maybe that's what happened.
Yeah.
So the basic herring, you know, life cycle, as I understand it, you know, they come in, my experience is of seeing it in Sitka Sound. So the herring come in March,
yep,
more or less, and spawn here. Sometimes there's a couple weeks later or something, there's a smaller spawn, mm-hmm, that might, mm-hmm, happen. But generally, the bulk of it seems to happen around the same time. Looking at the maps from Fish and Game over the years, like,
right,
at least in the last few decades, it's not consistent in one area.
Right. Yeah.
Mostly it's in the Sound, but some of those years they were like on the outer shore of Kruzoff, that they, mm-hmm, were spawning out there. But so then they hatch after, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, something like that.
Yep.
And then,
yep,
they're going out. Somebody was telling me that the adults will come back and start eating the hatchlings sometimes. I don't know, mm-hmm, if that seems kind of...
Well, it's interesting. So when adult herrings spawn, they deplete all of their energy reserves.
Yeah.
They lose tremendous amounts of weight. They give up lots and lots of calories while they're doing that. It's very energetically demanding. And so a lot of times when you're sampling adult herring after they have spawned out adult herring, you'll find herring eggs in their stomach. So they're kind of, so herring have this way of feeding. It's called ram feeding, where they can open their mouths and just swim through the water, and then whatever's in the water column just, you know, ends up in their mouth. And I suspect that's what they're doing a lot after they get done spawning. They try and do a little ram feeding to eat herring eggs. But yeah. But then once those herring eggs mature on the beaches and the eggs hatch and the little larvae come out, they just kind of get swept into whatever currents are available.
So they're kind of planktonic at,
yeah,
that point.
And yeah,
just from, you know, reading the news articles and so forth, my understanding is it's a couple of years before they start to show up in ways that they're easy to monitor at that point.
Yeah.
Just because of size.
Well,
yeah,
you can find juvenile herring around, but basically those larvae will get swept into currents, and it's hard to know. I don't really have a good sense. I can talk about Prince William Sound better. I spent a lot of time looking at juvenile herring in Prince William Sound, and if you can think of Prince William Sound as like a giant bay, right, and a lot of the herring spawning has been happening on the eastern side of the Sound, and then the larvae get swept into the currents that carry them over to the western side of the Sound, and they're feeding in the water column there. And then as they metamorphose from larvae to like little baby fish, they'll settle out of the water column into really, really near shore environments, and they'll take up residence in bays, like in eelgrass beds and, you know, or where there's a lot of structure and places to hide, and they'll take up residence in these near shore habitats, and they'll live there till maybe they're around age 2. They'll live there for a while, in getting progressively deeper into the water column, and look, because the bigger they get, the more food they need, so they got to range around a lot more, and then eventually they get so big in those habitats that they kind of got to move out into deeper water. And then this part's not very clear, but somehow they then will meet up with adult stocks, and then they'll join those adult stocks on foraging grounds and around. So then by time it's like maybe at around age 2.5 or so, they'll join up with them. And then when those adults go back to spawn, that's where they learn where to go spawn. Mm. And if they don't find adults, then they got to find their own place to spawn. And that's one mechanism by which you see these spawn spots move around, is that some of these fish that don't learn from older fish where to go spawn will start spawning in their own locations. And if they're successful, then they'll continue to return to that spot. And there are offspring will return to those spots. And that's what's thought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting to consider the implications of that because, I mean, for population mixing or whatever, because mm-hmm. the currents could theoretically bring these fish to someplace pretty different if there was something going on at the time, storm or whatever.
Well, sure. Yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah.
But if they can find a herring population there, then they just move in. And I guess that provides genetic mixing across.
Yeah, so like in Prince William Sound, it seems pretty clear that the adult populations are out there foraging outside the sound on the shelf break, you know, in the northern Gulf of Alaska. They're sort of headed over towards, you know, Cook Inlet and the northern part of Kodiak. That's where their adults from Prince William Sound will go forage. Just like here, the adults will go forage on the shelf break here. And there were some tagging studies done in the 30s, I think, where they actually tagged the herring in Sitka Sound. And they recovered a lot of those tags down around Craig.
Huh.
And so the thought was that the fish were just, as they go out onto the foraging grounds, they're just out on that shelf break and work in that shelf break to the south. And then when it becomes time to spawn, they turn around and come back and then they'll school up in deep water here in the Sound in the maybe January or so, and then as the time comes to spawn, then they'll start moving into shallower waters, and that's when the sea lions and the birds start picking them up.
So the young ones are basically on their own, more or less, until 2.5. Then they find the adults, hang out in the school. They're not spawning that first year, generally speaking. I mean, that first year that they're with the big schools.
Yeah, those are the age threes. So they're 3-year-old at that point in time.
All right,
so that's typically their first year spawning. We don't know very well whether or not herring skip spawn. Mm-hmm. So we think they spawn every year. But they could, and we don't know that how many. We know that the youngest ones we see spawning are 3, but we don't know if all the 3s are spawning.
I see, yeah.
So there's still lots and lots of real basic questions. So the idea of skip spawning is also interesting because, you know, maybe they come in and spawn at age 3, but then they don't come back till age 5. That doesn't seem to be the case when you look at the data, but skip spawning, when I left NOAA, that was one of the big things that was starting to show up in data. People were starting to identify, like, skip spawning in, I think it was black cod were skip spawning, and some other surprising species were skip spawning.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember somebody from NOAA came and gave a talk about black cod once and the sort of the interesting dynamics of their spawning abundance and how it could be like the spawning abundance was hugely variable from year to year. And it seems like that, I mean, I don't know how much of it's due to just conditions at the time in the ocean and so forth, but again, just from sort of like following along in the newspaper each year, it seems like the herring have like recruitment isn't stable from year, like some years are banner years for for production and other years not so much, but you know, when you average out across the, you know, 10-year average lifetime or whatever it is that they're living, then the population can do what it does. It isn't nearly as variable as the individual, recruitment spikes.
Yeah, it's like if you get a big, huge banner year for the age threes when they come in, you'll see that banner year work its way through. So the next year, the age fours will be really abundant, and then the year after that, there'll be the age fives will be really abundant. But then, of course, there's mortality. There's the fishing mortality taking place, and then there's also regular mortality taking place. So even though the big banner year is still there for that year class, there's still a really strong year class, but they get smaller and smaller as time goes on.
Yeah. And I guess thinking long term, you need to have those kind of every few years.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is like with herring, the idea. All of this is, this may have changed, but the idea there was that typically you would get really strong year classes that would sustain the population over time.
Yeah.
So you might get a really strong year class every 2 or 3 years, and that would sustain the population. And then if you get like 2 year classes in a row that are really strong, then you got herring all over the place. And I have not. I have to admit, I haven't been looking at the data the last few years.
Yeah.
So I know that Sitka Sound's been really strong the last few years, and I suspect you probably have multiple age classes that are year classes that are pretty big.
Yeah, it's like I say, it's not something that I follow super closely, and it sounds like since your retirement, it's on to other things for you as well, which makes sense. But it is just kind of interesting to me to think about. I know there's a lot of like different perspectives on how it should all be done and worked on. But like for me, I just mostly approach it with curiosity. I'm like, yeah, I mean, what's going on here? And if there are these sort of like stable state kind of equilibrium basins that, maybe there's a possibility of shifting it up to a higher stable state, and that kind of thing. But
yeah, I don't know. It always seemed funny to me that we should fish for a fish that everybody wants to eat.
Yeah.
That, we all like king salmon, and king salmon love to eat herring, so why would you eat king salmon food? Why would you go after king salmon food?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
that or halibut food or,
Some, questions there. And
I mean, there's priorities. Everybody has their own set of priorities. And, clearly if you're a commercial fisherman, your priority is catch fish.
Yeah, and that's, I don't have I don't have a boat in the race, so to speak, for myself. So I have the luxury of sort of being curious about it. But it's just like so much is, it seems like there's a lot of work that's been done, especially in Prince William Sound area. But also there's still so many basic things that we just don't really know well.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know.
Yeah.
And herring are really curious fish. Every time you think you got something figured out, they prove you wrong.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of the natural world that's kind of that way. This endless nuance variability that. Like they didn't ask us about our boxes. I guess that's kind of what it seems like to me sometimes. So you were telling me before we started recording, you actually came to Alaska, to experience Alaska a little bit.
Yeah.
Back in, 1980?
Yeah. I came up here in 1980 I had graduated from college in 79, and I was supposed to go to grad school in New Mexico, and that just really seemed dry and not like, whoa, a desert. Yeah. I had no appreciation for deserts at that time.
Yeah.
Now I do. I have a lot more appreciation for deserts. And so I decided not to go to grad school there and came up here to go to grad school. And I had contacted Dick Gard, who was a fisheries biologist at UAJ, University of Alaska, Juneau at the time. And I was interested in doing whale research, and he'd been working with Chuck Jaraz, and they had been sorting out this concept that whales have unique tails. And that was right when they were figuring that out. And so he had written a proposal to kind of continue that research. So he wrote back to me and said, you should come to Alaska and study whales. So I was like, okay. What I didn't realize is there's a big difference between writing the proposal and actually having the funding.
Right.
Those are two different things. And he didn't get funded. And so here I was in Alaska with my friends and no job offer. But luckily, Ensorah was just starting up at the time and was ready to collect their first round of broodstock. So the woman I arrived in Alaska with, who later became my wife, we got a job on a weir on Montana Creek in Juneau. And didn't know what a weir was, didn't know what a salmon was, but, we figured it out.
Yeah, yeah, I got started. I come in from Illinois. I guess you wouldn't really have a reason to know some of that stuff.
Yeah, but yeah, I've never really been much of a fisherman.
Yeah.
I enjoy catching fish, but I don't. It seems inefficient to do it with a hook and a pole.
Right. Fair enough. I like getting pictures a lot more than I like catching things. My dad and my son both love to fish and mm-hmm. hunt, and I'm happy to eat what they catch.
Yeah.
But I'm not so excited about actually. I'll tag along with a camera and like
sure.
get pictures of yeah. flowers or
yeah
moss or whatever it is that I'm seeing out there. But It's a lot of opportunities for that around here for sure. So you worked for NCRAW for a few years or just the season?
It was just that summer I worked for NCRAW, and then it was a series of other jobs, you know. And then I did go to graduate school because I was intent on doing that.
Yeah.
And then eventually got a job with NOAA in Juneau and worked for them for a long time, for like 35 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I started at Little Port Walter.
Okay. So, Sitka area.
Yeah. Actually, I passed through Sitka quite a bit in those years.
Yeah.
And, I was working on a joint project. My first job down there was working on a joint project that they had with NCRAW. That's actually where my graduate funding came from. We were starting the lake stocking work that NCRAW does over the...
Deer Lake,
yeah. And I worked with Steve Reifenstuhl and Jan Straley, and we were doing these lake surveys and I'd live on these lakes all summer long and go out and sample the water and decide if the lake was suitable for stocking. And I'm trying to think. We stocked Banner Lake. That was one of the lakes we stocked when I first started. That way it was a test to see how that would work.
On South Baranof?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of a great job, you know. It's like you get up in the morning and go to a different lake every day and go check it out.
Yeah.
And hang out on it for a day or two, and then the next you'd go to another lake. And then, So
these are, fun. I mean, there's a ton of lakes on Baranof.
Yeah.
But these would be ones that had barrier falls
right.
or something.
Yeah, these lakes all have a barrier, so they had no endemic salmon or salmonid populations.
Yeah.
Although the one I was hired for my thesis project, I was supposed to look at this lake called the Rostislav Lakes. There's a series of three of them. And they're like, where is there? Around Port Herbert down there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were supposedly rainbows in those lakes that have been stocked. A lot of those lakes on Lower Baranof are stocked with rainbows by the guys working at the herring reduction plants.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they'd collect these steelhead, and then they'd haul them up into the lakes and dump them in there. And I think in probably the upper Rostislav Lake, I probably caught the last rainbow.
Oh.
I my job was to census the lake, and I fished and fished and fished, and I never caught anything. And the lake is really sterile. I mean, there's like, talk about oligotrophic. I mean, it was all summer long. You could like almost see to the bottom the whole time. And then eventually I caught this gnarly old rainbow that I aged out at 12 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it looked pretty beat up and old. And
So,
I probably caught the last one.
Wow.
But I ended up working on Osprey Lake, which was closer to Little Port Walter.
And yeah.
That one had a Dolly Varden population in it that somebody had stocked. It was another barrier lake, but there was a plant there in Port Walter that somebody had obviously thrown dollies in there. And so we stocked that one. I did the preliminary work, and then we stocked it with Chinooks. And then they all got parasitized.
Oh.
and everything in the lake pretty much had really high mortality, the dollies and the Chinooks.
Because there was something already in the lake that was...
Well, there were gulls that were mew gulls nesting on the lake, and the mew gulls carry this parasite. And so when they're flying over the lake, they... poop the parasite out, and then the copepods take up the parasite, and then the fish eat the parasitized copepods, and then the fish get parasitized. So then they kind of tend to laze around at the surface and become very vulnerable to the gulls when the life cycle of the parasite is completed.
Yeah, those parasite life cycles are kind of wild and a little bit disconcerting, I have to say, sometimes.
So then I was living at Little Port Walter for a lot. I spent a lot of time down there. Yeah. And then eventually got a job with NOAA working at Little Port Walter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you went there with NSRAW to begin with.
And yeah. Well, it was a joint project
they
were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was the grad student.
I see. Yeah. Well, you know, I had a chance to visit Rezanoff Lake, which is on South Baranof, big lake, 800 feet. And it was stocked at some point, I imagine, by plane, because it's not an easy lake to get to otherwise. But my impression was that, I don't know, was it in the early 1900s that there's a lot of different sort of stocking
programs? There was a project done at Little Port Walter, Frank Thrower did it, where he went back and dug back through all these records and was trying to find the histories of stocking in all of these lakes. And many of them were repeatedly stocked by people just working in these plants. Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and he started looking at how they had all sort of genetically diverged, especially around Little Port, because the only stream that there's, I think, the Bordino, was it, or Sashen Creek has a steelhead run in it, and I think that was the only one, and that was the source stock for all of these lakes, and so they were able to kind of figure out the genetics.
Some founder effect, because there's probably not that many that went in, and then slow divergence by
some
selection.
Of them were pretty small pods.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of them, you know, like Deer Lake is huge.
It's interesting. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, I mean, these are basically isolated lakes. They, you know, if they're productive enough, the fish will stay there and just keep being what they're being and gradually diverging over time.
Yeah. That was actually what my thesis was. My master's thesis was looking at Dolly Varden are really plastic. They have really plastic life histories. So if there's not a lot of energy available to them, then they'll not grow very fast. Those fish will like live in the near shore habitats and eat insects, like, you know, little bugs in the water and stuff. But some of them will take up residence in the middle of the lake, and they'll eat zooplankton, and they'll be kind of like a big, beautiful silver Dolly Varden that you might want to catch off the beach here. And so in this lake, in this Osprey Lake, which was barrier, those big ones might want to migrate out, but they never come back because there's, you know, a huge waterfall.
Right,
they're never going to come back. And so it was interesting. I was looking at the divergence of these two different types of Dolly Varden in the lake. And I marked them. So I was looking at their movements, and they didn't. In the wintertime, they would all kind of come together at the bottom of the lake. But then in the spring, they would go back to their respective habitats. And there was a little difference in the timing of their spawning.
So would small ones that spawn, like would some of the juveniles become large ones, or did they tend to?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. But actually, I think there's a famous lake in Greenland, Thingvalden Lake, where there's a lot of work done on this sort of, they called it incipient speciation. Mm-hmm. And these were Arctic char, which are very closely related to Dolly Varden. And they were definitely producing their own kind.
Yeah.
Starting to produce their own kind in that lake. So I suspect the same thing's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, it's because like you say, if the large ones, I suppose there's an advantage if one of them, if some of them start to not do the out-migration thing, then suddenly that mimics, there's obviously a selection pressure for those to become dominant because they're the ones still around reproducing.
Yeah, and then there's also, there are these serious morphological differences, even like in their mouth parts and stuff.
Oh, really? So,
yeah.
Huh.
You get these, the ones that are near shore, like you'll get a 7-year-old fish and it'll be like, that's like less than 4 inches long.
Yeah.
And then they're kind of, their mouths look really pretty well adapted for foraging on the bottom. They call them benthophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the ones that are out in the middle, you know, they're more limnetic and they are more like feeding on zooplankton, and their mouths look more like you would expect a salmonid's mouth to look like. And so, How much of that was phenotypic plasticity, just the ability to change, to respond to the conditions that we're growing in, is chars like Dolly Varden and Arctic char and those sorts of species, they're really famous for really having very plastic life histories, or they easily adapt to whatever environment they're in.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Medvechi Lake here, which is upstream from Bear Cove Hatchery.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I actually looked, but I remember some years ago noticing little tiny fish just along, and it's well up. I mean, it's barriered.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Presumably somebody threw some fish in there at some point back in the day, and then the ones that I saw were right along in the very shallow water there, really small, probably doing that.
Yeah, doing that same thing. Yeah.
And I don't know if there's any or would be any, because that's one of those very clear lakes that you can see to the bottom all summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's kind of algae that grows along the bottom, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of stuff in the water column.
Yeah. So they're probably just in this sort of low energy environment, and so they take on a low energy lifestyle.
Huh. And so they can, I mean, they can mature and spawn. Is the amount of, is the abundance, so like the number of eggs they're laying? I mean, I would guess it ends up being smaller, but maybe the eggs are just smaller and the numbers is similar.
Yeah, I didn't see a difference in the egg sizes between them.
Oh, really? So the little ones.
But certainly, you know, length, the size of the fish is a good indicator of how many eggs it's producing.
Oh, okay.
But some of those little adult, really little dollies that I looked at, they were only producing like 8 eggs.
Wow.
10 eggs.
So. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, it seems like the whole sort of life history, sort of a reproductive pattern of like lots of babies, high mortality. Like if you're only producing 8, then you either got to live a long time.
Right.
And so your lifetime production is greater, or you got to have higher survival of the few that you have.
Yeah. I would imagine the mortality rates on those fish was probably pretty low. There weren't any predators besides gulls or things like that that were going to eat them in the lakes. So they could hang out for a long time. So I don't know what their lifetime fitness would look like. But.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to think, you know, just sort of forwarding through well beyond any of our lifetimes, you know, what's kind of the end stage of end stage isn't even right, but you know, the long term, you know, 1,000 years from now, and you know, how things
that was the go question forward. Were they going to ultimately be two different species living in that lake?
And I mean, I guess you can kind of look back in time, some of the studies that people do with the proglacial lakes at the edge of the ice sheets that were big and extensive, mm-hmm. and then separated out into, so all of these things that were connected, you know, 15,000 years ago, and now each lake has its own, you know, they're separated.
Sure. Yeah, like all those different millions of different types of sunfish in the Midwest, and all those ponds that were left by the glacial retreat, you know, and there's just a million different kinds of sunfish.
And they just kind of adapt to the local conditions over time, and it's fascinating to, because, you know, we have our own experience, but then we have this ability to kind of look back and imagine forward in time in these various ways, and just try to get a little bit of a sense of, you know, it's, I mean, that's what, even just on the small scale, like walking through the forest and so forth, and it's like, oh, it seems the same, and then we'll have some major event, and it feels like this big disruption in a way. But kind of broad scale, like these things are happening all the time,
right.
more or less. I remember talking to Brian Buma about landslides, for example.
And
the scale that he's working on is hundreds and thousands of years. And
right,
it's like,
right.
oh, landslides happen all the time.
Yeah.
But in my lifetime, you know, there's a handful of them that are significant, you know, along the road system or something like that.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing working with geologists. Is they think about time very differently than I was used to thinking about time. I thought when I was doing fisheries, I thought it was great that we were actually conceiving of seasonality in the work that we were doing. Because, a lot of fisheries biologists are just thinking about the period when they can collect fish and sample, and we were focused on seasonality. But then you start working with the geologists, and they're like, oh, well, in the last million years, this and, you know, so landslides occur all the time.
Right.
It's like, well, I don't think about time in terms of millions of years.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's like when you're operating at human scales and you say, well, you know, what's the chance that a landslide happens here, for example?
Yeah.
Well, you know, once every 1,000 years. Well, great.
Yeah.
You know, my house is fine, you know, unless it happens to be in the next 50 years.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So the kind of scale matters. But
sure,
in a geologist sort of time frame, 1,000 years is a blink of an eye.
Right.
So
yeah, I was listening to a discussion in Juneau when they were talking about the landslide maps, and they wanted there was a discussion about whether the city was going to accept these landslide hazard maps. And one of the citizens that was testifying in front of the city said, well, you know, I know this map says there's landslide hazard on my property, a high landslide hazard. But I got to tell you, there's 300-year-old trees right above my house. So I don't think landslides occur. And all I could think of was, that's like a blink of an eye.
Yeah. I mean, it's
in
similar
geology time.
Yeah, with the earthquake hazards and things,
right.
Like, you know, you hear about the Cascadia quake zone and overdue for a major quake there in the
right.
Seattle area, and how much infrastructure is there now.
Right.
And you're like, it's
yeah, right.
I don't like to read about that before I fly into Seattle. Chances that it happens while I'm there, pretty low, but chances
yeah.
that it happens sometime in the next 100 years, pretty high, is kind of the sense
like
that
yeah.
I get from the
yeah.
geology sort of approach to it.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I mean, it's mitigating risk, I guess, is kind of what it comes down to,
yeah.
and understanding the risk and seeing what makes sense.
Well, people, yeah, that's another thing, the work we've been doing with the landslides, one of the things we're doing is thinking about risk and how people think about risk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. You think of Klukwan, right? So Klukwan is built on a debris fan. They live where landslides all the time. And they live there because that interaction between the Chilkat River eroding away that debris, and that debris being constantly replenished, it creates conditions where salmon can spawn. Chums will come in and spawn late into December, which is why the Eagle Preserve is right there. And that's why the people live there, is because there's this constant supply of food. And yet they live in this area that a lot of people would think was incredibly risky, because there's continual landslides on that mile 23 landslide fan. So it's kind of fascinating how they think of risk, you know, and it's compared to, say, how my 96-year-old mother would think of risk.
Right.
It's a very different story.
Well, yeah, and it's just, I mean, the other thing is how we've shifted our expectations of how long things last, you know? So
right.
when you're expecting to need to rebuild a house every 20 years or something
sure.
like that,
yeah.
then, like, yeah, great. So I had to rebuild it
yeah.
5 years earlier or something,
okay.
you know,
yeah.
whatever.
Maybe next time I'll get
yeah.
25 years.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah exactly. It's yeah. kind of, whereas now we build this major infrastructure where we're hoping it lasts generations
well,
in some
yeah.
cases.
And, yeah.
And then,
yes.
you know, the costs end up being higher
right.
for these events when they happen. And it's just, yeah, it doesn't seem like there's right answers. There's just different answers with different trade-offs and
right.
those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it's all kind of what you're willing to put up with, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The nice thing about the landslides here in this region seems that they're, like most of the time they aren't going to happen. You know, the weather conditions that are sort of necessary for them to happen, generally speaking,
mm-hmm.
at least the major ones. I guess there's other kinds of landslides that can happen as well, but these you know, heavy rain
yeah.
induced ones. So if you live in a zone, then you know, it's not that hard to like be vacant for
right.
a day or two, a few days a year, maybe, you know, in those kinds of conditions.
Yeah. One of the podcasts, there was a podcast made about the situation in Juneau with the landslide hazard there. And they interviewed a woman, and her house is, I don't know, in Juneau, there's this area called Evergreen Bowl. It's right downtown, but it's a steep-sided bowl. At the bottom, there's a park, and Gold Creek runs through it. But there's some houses perched right on the edge of the bowl up really high. And, I mean, if you drive on Basin Road in Juneau, those are the houses that are like right on the edge of this big tall cliff.
Hmm.
And those houses, you know, you don't have to be a geologist to know that there's a risk of those houses falling off those cliffs one
way
or another.
Someday they're going down.
Yeah, and so they interviewed a woman that lived there, and she goes, yeah, I understand that I live in a really high-hazard place, and this my house is clearly at risk of falling in. She goes, but, you know, I love my house, and my house is, it's my space. It's where I can be myself, and I can, you know, kind of hold the world at bay and be in the place where I feel most comfortable and can be. And so that the value of that to her clearly outweighed any concern she had about the her safety being in that house.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, it's an incredibly beautiful spot, and you know, it was her place in the world.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty poignant discussion in that podcast.
Yeah. It's an interesting, and everybody kind of has to make their own choices. And, you know, it's not here in Southeast. We often talk about landslides. I know in Juneau, like historically, it seems like there's houses in places that have historically been prone to avalanches.
Right, right.
Coming down in the wintertime.
Why are there only elders around the house?
Right. And that obviously is a problem as well. And those are less tied to specific weather, it seems like. You know, they could come down, whatever releases them. And in recent years, you know, the flooding of the Mendenhall River, those eucalypts or whatever they call them, you know, the Suicide Basin, I guess, draining out and creating this massive.
Well, now the city's had to adapt to that. So they put all these barriers up to reduce the flooding. But that, of course, is accelerating the speed of the water moving down the river. So the places that are maybe unprotected down lower in the river are probably now going to be more at risk. And
I
wonder how that's all going to play out in the end.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where it's like it works fine as long as it's below a certain threshold, but if it gets above that threshold, it's way worse kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, and because and it's just hard to know. You know, down south, you know, flood zones, people building in flood zones of these major rivers that don't flood every year, but like they're such huge rivers. Like that's the thing that's hard. Growing up in Sitka, especially, you know, we don't have. You know, the longest watershed here might be 10 miles, 15 miles at the most.
Yeah.
So I remember talking to Richard Carsonson once, and he asked me, oh, so when's the high water in the rivers there? And I was like, it's always in the fall. Isn't it that way everywhere? And he was mystified because he was like, no, high water's in the spring. It's like, wait. And then I was thinking about it. I'm like, okay, so you have the Stikine, which is this major watershed, transboundary, goes across the mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would have to be a mighty, mighty rain in order for that whole watershed to be impacted by
it.
Whereas here, the entire watershed is impacted by a single rain system all the time. But on the other hand, there you have the entire watershed full of snow.
Right.
And so when that all melts at once, it can be, you know, then downstream you get this combined effect that's huge in the springtime. Whereas our watersheds here aren't that big. So the amount of snow that can melt at any given time is smaller than the amount of rain that we would get in a heavy rain event.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, Sitka forms my baseline understanding of things. And so, like, thinking about some of these glacial systems or mainland river systems.
Well, glacial systems, they'll peak in the summertime when the ice is melting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
and if they have those, you know, outflow events from side channels and those
yokelips, But, yeah, it's kind of interesting. There was a paper that came out right when we were starting our landslide stuff that classified all these systems in Alaska and was pointing that out. You have these snow-fed systems that they're like kind of springtime flooding, and then the glacial systems are summertime, and then you have the rain-fed systems like you have here where they're peaking more in the fall. But they all are different from each other, the three different types of systems.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing even just watching, you know, Indian River here, Costaheen, it's not big, but just how much even, you know, it's changing the gravel bars you know, how much, despite the smaller, and it must just be happening primarily in those main events. I think normal flow probably isn't moving a huge amount of sediment, but these high water events, you know, just the massive amounts of sediment that move down and then multiply that by, you know, orders of magnitude for some of these larger river systems. And it's just like there's a lot of material getting moved all the time. And I think in my mind, it's like this, I call it kind of a dynamic equilibrium. Unless you're really paying attention, it seems the same, unless it hits, you know, your house or your neighborhood, and then there's this event that happens.
Well, it's kind of the beauty of living in one place for a really long time that you see these changes taking place. You know, you like in Juneau, well, of course, there's the glacier. You can see the glacier moving, right? And I can think about when I used to take my daughter to the glacier and where we would go. And the ice has not been there for a really long time now. It's really moved back. And or there's a Herbert River further out the road in Juneau. And that, with this lot of glacial retreat right now, it's a glacial-fed river. It's really altered. The erosion pattern is really changing, and it's really changing these gravel bars that are right there at the mouth of the river and sort of changing the way the flow pattern is. And it's just kind of, and so it starts cutting into the land and knocking trees down, and you see all that going on. And it's like, when I was growing up in Illinois, it was a very stable landscape.
Right.
It didn't ever seem like it changed. And the only reason it changes is because they build new interstates through it. But
yeah.
But then you come here and we have this really dynamic sort of landscape that is not in any sort of equilibrium at all because it's so geologically young.
Yeah.
That these changes, you can see really dramatic changes in the course of your life.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up here and I didn't notice that so much when I was a kid.
Right.
But you know, and part of it's because it's such a, you know, it feels like so long, those, like, let's call them 10 years from the age of 8 to 18, you know, where you're sort of like starting to incorporate a sense of how things are. Mm-hmm. It seems like forever.
And,
you know, kind of is for you at that point.
Well, yeah.
But now, pushing on 50, it's like it was such a small window.
Right.
You know, when I think about what's normal weather to me or you know, how much. And so I, partly because of my background in statistics, I like to kind of consciously think about, well, what's variation? What's normal variation?
Right.
Because it's so easy to kind of feel like, especially given human timescales, to feel like, you know, things are pretty stable until they're not. But that actually might be pretty normal amounts of variation. And it's just, if you don't actually make yourself think about it, it's easy to not do that.
Well, yeah. Well, you think about, you know, the people in Hoonah who tell the story of living in Glacier Bay.
Oh, yeah.
And then the ice chased them out. Now the ice is gone. They would probably kind of like to go back, but there's a national park there. That led to another issue. But in their experience, there's tremendous changes taking place, and they're aware of those changes.
Yeah, it's fascinating the kind of the oral histories and so forth that people have in their culture, in their communities, and the access to sort of that deeper understanding of how things have been.
Yeah.
And you know, and then also talking to folks like Sue Carl, I spoke to a few years ago, who, you know, was the primary author on the geologic map of Baranof Island.
Mm-hmm.
And so just talking to her about the, like, millions of years history, 100 million year history of, like, how did these rocks come to be here? And it's like, wow, you know, it's like you say, with the geologists, it's a whole different thing. You know, 1,000 years seems a long time in human history. And it's just like, multiply that by 1,000, you get to 1,000,000 years, and we're talking 100 million years.
Know? Exactly. So, a really long time.
It's kind of it's stretches my mind a little bit to try and kind of work through all that.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if you ever talked to Annette Patton when she was working here. She was the one that developed the landslide app that we have here. She built the algorithm for that. And so she did a lot of geology here when we were first starting the project. And I was asking her, I was like, how, you know, at that time I was like, how do you think about 100 million years ago? And she said, well, you know, when you start off as an undergraduate in geology, they kind of start to beat that into your head, the thinking about time in different ways. And and that was really enlightening to me. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Then I ended up reading a book called, what was it? But it was about how geologists think about time.
Oh, okay.
I can't think of it. I have no memory.
So. Yeah. Well, speaking of thinking about time, it is. I've had a chance to work with spend some time with some geologists doing some work, mostly on post-glacial geology around here.
Right.
And, it's even that. It's just like, okay, so just trying to imagine the ice was here. It retreated. What's the pattern of the retreat?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ash, when did it fall?
Yeah.
You know, where was the ice relative to the ash, when the ash was falling, and these kinds of questions, which you know, there's fragmentary evidence that you can find if you go look for it,
right,
and you have the right tools.
Yeah.
And start to piece together a little bit of that story. And it's just a fascinating way to indulge curiosity, I guess, and try and understand, you know, where this place has been and, you know, what sort of things might be coming in the future.
Well, and then just think how this island kind of cruised across the Pacific,
right,
and then slammed into North America.
That's what was amazing. It's just like it came across and Sue, if I'm remembering my conversation with Sue, it hit North America kind of down by Vancouver Island,
right,
and then
it kind of
took the fast train up, right, and like, you know, zoomed by Haida Gwaii and then up along here, and it's like on this by tectonic standards moving quite quickly,
right,
you know,
yeah,
and different than most of Southeast Alaska,
right,
geologically.
Exactly.
So,
and like,
yeah,
up in Yakutat's own plate, and it's kind of spinning and sinking underneath the North American plate. And
on those glaciers are working just as fast as the uplift, and it's so much erosion there.
Right.
I can't remember. It's like, it seems like they're saying, I've read that's the highest rates of erosion in the world are on that, the St. Elias range up there.
Yeah. It's just like, first you got to wonder, how did these guys figure this stuff,
right,
out? How do they think about this? So,
well, and then those massive rock falls. I mean, that's part of the erosion, I guess. You know, the massive rock fall that was on the glacier, went over a glacier in Glacier Bay that they, you know, seismically they were able to find it. It was that big, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there was the Ton Fjord one that was up by Yakutat that, you know, created a wave.
Right.
And, you know, of course, the famous Lituya Bay one, but all of these kind of movements of things.
Yeah. Well, and then there was that one, was it in Iceland or Greenland last winter?
It
last winter? And it was like a Lituya Bay situation where this side of this mountain fell into this fjord. And it was very difficult for the water to get out of the fjord. And it just sloshed back and forth within the fjord, wiping things out for like 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it was in this really remote area. And they found it because these seismometers all over the planet were picking it up. And nobody knew, what is this? And they kind of triangulated and they figured out and they went. And it was just this like incredible event in this fjord where it just denuded everything. And like, washed away whole hillsides.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, we're so small in scale relative to some of these events. It's kind of incredible to consider them and think about them and, mostly avoid them as much as possible, you know, in practice.
Right.
It's like, be far away and be curious, but try not to get in the middle of it. So.
Yeah.
Well, so we're kind of coming to the end of our time here. Anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
No. No, I'm good.
Well, thanks for coming in, and I guess it sounds like your main work with the Science Center is wrapping up here, and will be wrapped up by the time this airs. But probably be doing a little bit of stuff on the side forward.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of stuff that started that I want to kind of watch it, finish out, and so I'll stay a little bit attached. So
nice.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it's been a great opportunity to come to Sitka. I was just telling somebody today my trips to Sitka, they're like little mini vacations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I come and I can get completely absorbed in the science that I'm doing and talking with people and thinking about it. And then I can just kind of wander around town, go for walks, and it's like vacation.
Nice. Yeah, science vacation.
Science vacation, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in.
Sure.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Ron Heintz. He is a fisheries biologist who spent 35 years with NOAA and more recently a few years with the Sitka Sound Science Center here in Sitka. I want to thank him for taking some time to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. You can also hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and see what I've been observing there and leave me a comment. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCW, Sitka.